Welcome to the fourth installment of the Developing Perspective interview series. Today I am delighted and pleased to be joined by Brent Simmons of many things, of which he'll introduce himself in a minute. The interview series is something that I do to kind of break out of the 15-minute mold of just kind of myself talking and talk to interesting developers about how they work, about why they work, and about some of the interesting projects that they're working on. So, hello, Brent.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Great to have you. I was wondering if you could just start off by just kind of giving a little brief overview of kind of your background in development, what the kind of things you've worked on, and so on.
Well, let's see. I'm an indie developer as of a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
And I've been thank you very much. I've been an indie developer before. This is actually my third time. This time it's going to stick. I'm quite sure.
There you go.
And I'm probably most famous for having written NetNewsWire, which was a popular RSS reader for many years. I also created MarsEdit. Most recently, Glassboard was my recent iOS app that I worked on when I was at Sepia Labs. And that's where I worked until the end of January.
Great. And so where did you actually get your start in development? Is that the kind of thing that you've just sort of always been doing? Or did you just sort of at some point decide, you know, hey, I like writing software and I'm going to get into it? Or where did you write your first code?
Well, I'm a second generation geek. Both my parents were programmers. Dad was COBOL and mom was Fortran.
Nice.
So the very first code I ever wrote was before I had even actually touched a computer with my own hands. Mom had some Fortran books at home, and so I wrote out some kind of for loop or something that did something. Wrote it out longhand. She took it to work, typed it in. It didn't work. She came back, told me there was a bug. Didn't tell me what the bug was. That's got to be about the slowest debugging method known to man, right?
Yes.
You know, giving longhand code to your mom, waiting for the next evening. Yeah. But yeah, I started that way. They got me an Apple II Plus when I was a kid. So I got into BASIC and then 6502 Assembler, which you had to do if you wanted to write any games, you know, and you wanted any kind of performance at all. And things just kind of happened from there. I've been in the Apple world, I guess, since about 1980.
Wow. Yeah, so you've been...
It's a long time.
Yeah, and so that was even pre-Objective-C, all this kind of stuff now, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, I started writing Mac code in the 90s and went indie the first time in 1995, right as Apple was entering its darkest days. But I was going to be an indie Mac developer come hell or high water.
Okay.
And I stuck with it.
That's great.
Well, I got a job for a while, but, you know.
Sure. Yeah, and so just sort of in terms of moving into the sort of the current day, so obviously most of what you're doing is, I imagine, in Objective-C and potentially some kind of server language. Is that right? Or
I haven't done server-side programming in a very long time. However, I expect I probably will be doing some of that soon. And what I've looked at most is Node.js. Or Node.js. I don't know how people say it.
I don't know.
I don't love JavaScript by any means, but it looks pretty modern. It's Node does, at least. And so I think that's probably the direction I'm going to go. Because, you know, iCloud has not really lived up to its promise, unfortunately. And just about every app idea I have, you know, needs some kind of back-end stuff. And so, you know, I'm probably going to have to go and relearn all that, you know, do it the modern way.
Yeah. Yeah, it is certainly something that I found interesting as I've almost every app I've worked on recently, I think all of them have some server-side backend. It's just other than maybe something like a game or something where you might be able to get away with it, but in general it seems like anything you do is going to at least do something in the cloud, whether that's actual document storage or just preferences syncing or something.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I had the luxury when I was working on Glassboard, we had a person and a half working on the back end, and they did a great job, and it was utterly fantastic. I never had to touch or even look at any of that code. And so it was wonderful, but now, yeah, I have to do it myself. So
yeah, the blessing and the curse of being an independent, right?
Yeah, now, yeah, indeed.
You've got to do it all.
Yeah. But, you know, all that stuff has come such a long way. than when I was indie last time, which was in the early to mid 2000s. In those days, you know, I might have been able to get a virtual machine, but probably I would have had to buy a server, put it in a rack, install the OS, install whatever, MySQL and everything else, keep everything up to date, pay a whole lot of money. These days, you know, there are all these services, you know, from Amazon to Azure, to Heroku to EngineYard that handle so many of these details for you. And it's so much cheaper, so much easier to maintain. Writing backend services is really, really different than it was 10 years ago. And I think that puts it in within reach of very small shops, you know, one or two or three people. Okay. And that makes a big difference. And that comes along right as the mobile explosion is happening. And, you know, thank goodness, right? These two things reinforce each other.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of crazy when I think about where the fact that I can, yeah, it's like just, you know, being a one-man team, I'm running currently probably about 7 or 8 servers for doing various things across various apps and platforms. And it's like, that doesn't even seem difficult anymore. It's like, if I need to scale something up, I just add a new machine and it boots up and you just add it up. And it's kind of insane that you can just do that in a way that it's not at all kind of enterprise-y anymore, whatever you want to call
it.
It's like, scary.
What do you like to use?
Most of what I host on Linode for the most part, which is a VPS. I've played around and done some of my stuff on things like EngineYard or Heroku, but I always find that I get stuck. I'm too much. I like being in the weeds a bit too much, or I like having a bit of control maybe too much. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I like being able to. It's like when something goes down, that I feel like I have some amount of control over how to fix it and how to get it back up, or those mistakes are typically caused by something I've done and I can directly fix them. Like when I started off on Heroku, and I think they've gotten better, but I remember it was incredibly frustrating where something someone else was doing would, you know, sort of take down the node I was on or something, and you just kind of be stuck. It's like, okay, well, I guess I'll just wait it out. And there's, you know, nothing I can tell anybody to do. And it's also just, there's something. It's also very cheap to do it that way. I mean, it's crazy that the kind of traffic and performance you can get out of a setup on Linode or something like that versus if you on any of the more kind of managed environments, you end up paying a whole lot more for a lot less bandwidth. And so it's for a cost perspective, especially kind of if you don't need the none of these things that are sort of like the free get as many users as possible, you know, scale to millions and millions systems.
Right.
It's sure, like if you start from this from a world where every user is giving you money, that it sort of naturally grows your user base at a much more manageable pace. So I can start off on one of these things. It's not like I need to start and on day one be able to support, you know, 10 million people. It's like maybe it's 100 people or 1,000 people.
Right. Well, that's definitely what I'm looking at for my future stuff. People are going to pay, right, for this. For my ongoing costs will be matched with ongoing revenue, ideally, right? So, yeah, it's got to be that way. So what kind of software do you like to run? Are you like a MySQL PHP guy, or are you running something newer, Ruby on Rails?
I'm a Rails guy. It was actually
Rails guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before I got into iPhone stuff, I was a contract Rails developer. So I've been independent for many years as a contractor, and then more recently into it as a sort of doing iOS stuff. But back in the day, that was my background, doing Rails stuff. And so it was just kind of the natural fit. I mean, it seems like for a lot of people on the server side, you just kind of, whatever your first thing that you get into just kind of sticks. If you start off as an OJS guy, you'll probably end up staying an OJS guy forever. If you just go into Rails you did that side of things. If you can get into Django or whatever it is on Python, that side of things. Mm-hmm. It's just like whatever you kind of pick up in, that's where you're comfortable. But yeah, I've been doing Rails for years now.
Okay.
And so that's just kind of, I think it's interesting in some ways where having to learn that though, it's to try and keep up to date when my focus is almost entirely on mobile now is always a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like every now and then I think recently there's this whole big thing going around with a big Rails security patch that had to come out. And it's like, I hear about that sort of third hand from somewhere else rather than being firsthand, because all the news I focused on and interested in is on the Apple side these days.
Yeah, same here. And that's kind of what worries me. And so why I look at something more managed like Azure or something, because they're going to take care of all that kind of stuff, or at least I imagine they will. And what I have to do is so small, right? Just insert some scripts here and there, set up a database, you know, the kind of easy stuff. And that way I can keep all of my attention, or whatever, almost all of my attention on making sure that my the actual app is fantastic, and keep the server side just as lean and basic as I possibly can, and needing as little of my own bandwidth as I can. But, you know, I do worry about those times when, well, the entire data center is down for 2 days or some crazy thing. Of course, that can happen in any case, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no such thing as sort of 100% uptime for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. Yeah.
But, and it is a nice thing, I guess, for the nice thing about working on mobile apps or these types, or I guess you call it like a thick client in the old parlance of like what they used to call it. It's like it's the apps can do so much when they're disconnected now that at least it's not quite as crushing an experience as if it's, you know, if it's a web app and the server's down, you're just done. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between, say, a Twitter app, a Twitter client. If Twitter goes down, you get nothing.
Yeah.
But if you've just written some back-end services that are just for syncing, and syncing doesn't work for a couple hours, well, you know, probably everything will be okay. It'll just sync when it comes back online, and all will be well.
Yeah, exactly. So when you sit down and are kind of wanting to get into a place of being productive, kind of focused, what is your sort of physical and kind of technological setup look like in terms of what do you, when you're kind of wanting to get into your zone and be in your most productive state, what does that look like for you?
Well, let's see. I have a nice office on the corner of the downstairs of my house. I've got two big windows and a skylight and a light box too, which I run every morning. So I let in a lot of light, turn on my big 27-inch iMac, and I don't have a laptop at the moment, though. That'll change soon. Plug in my iPad, which plays some podcasts or music or something, and I just sit and start working. The door to my office is closed. I just try to get rid of all interruptions. Nobody ever calls me. Thank God I've trained them well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I just sit and work. Yeah.
Do you do this? Do you tend to work just sort of during like traditional office hours, or you kind of want to work all hours of the night? It's crazy in the morning.
After dinner is really my best coding time, which is really unfortunate. I would so much like to get more done during the day, but there's some time before lunch, which is okay. But then after lunch, you know, I like to go get some exercise and maybe talk to my wife about a few things. Maybe I have to go to the dentist or something. There's always, you know, just kind of interruptions. So the afternoon tends to get broken up a lot. And if I don't have a good, you know, 3 hours at least blocked out, it's hard to get started at all. So a lot of coding is done after dinner, and then the day is taken up with whatever, email and other communications and stuff. Though ideally I get started coding sooner. Just today I did, tomorrow who knows.
Yeah, I imagine that's a big difference too, having with your newfound independence to have total control over your schedule again.
Yeah, it's nice not to have any, you know, company meetings or anything like that. That helps certainly.
And along those lines, what do you, as you're looking forward to being independent again, what aspects of that on a more daily basis are you most looking forward to, or sort of things that you missed when you were sort of working for in a larger team with a larger organization?
I think the biggest thing is the attitude towards software, knowing that, you know, we may have a ship date, but it is way more important to make the software awesome and ship later than to hit that ship date. That's a big part of it. Not having, you know, pressures. There's no, you know, board of directors breathing down our necks to, you know, get something out there, you know, so we can take the time to make sure it's really, really good. And that matters a ton to me. I really dislike the constraints imposed by probably really every corporate environment in the world, no matter how nice it was. And my last job was a very nice environment, but still, you know, there were people with expectations. And so sometimes we had to put stuff out before I thought it was ready to put out.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I always find is it reminds me a lot of, it's kind of when you're independent, you own all of the upside and all the downside of the decisions mm-hmm. you're making, right? And so you can choose what you're doing based on your values and sort of the things you can live with in mm-hmm. a way that is much more complicated whenever you're in a large organization. It's like if you shift something later and that means you're not getting money later, well, that's a decision you've made that directly impacts you and you can live with that. Like you've made mm-hmm. that choice rather than it being this weird amorphous thing where if, you know, who knows what.
Yeah. As soon as there's any kind of politics in it, that kind of takes a lot of the fun out of it. As long as everything is about the product and making it the best it can possibly be, and whether it's just you or you and one or two other guys, then it's fun, because then you're really doing what you love, right? You know, you're putting your heart into making something fantastic, and that's really the way to go. Put another way, I've been in this business for too long not to do it that way anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I've developed my skills over decades, and for me not to be able to put my heart into it fully would just be, it would be a personal tragedy. It would really, really suck. Yeah.
Do you ever worry in that about being able to draw the right lines and define what good enough is?
Oh, sure. All the time. Yeah. It's so, as you know, there are trade-offs with every single decision that you make. And in the end, you really do have to ship, right? You can't just go on and on and on and on forever. And that's hard. What I've learned, though, over the years is that I get better at making those decisions. And there are times when there are decisions that might have been tough for me 5 or 10 years ago, but that I can make more easily and quickly now. I've also learned that over the years, I just get better at doing this. So I can avoid having to make some of those decisions because I was more productive, because, you know, I already knew how to do whatever feature X is. You know, I've already done it. I didn't have to spend a whole bunch of time doing research and figure out how to do it and so on. That makes it a whole lot nicer.
Yeah. I think it's one of the hardest lessons, at least I know I've had to learn. I think there's a fundamental part of it that has to be practical when mm-hmm. ultimately you're not getting you're not getting a salary. Maybe it's the best way to say it. It's mm-hmm. like at the end of the day, you have to balance the kind of eccentric artist tendency that I think a lot of software engineers have, that you have this kind of like this, you just want to keep working on the interesting problem and keep working on it until it's perfect. And you have to mm-hmm. find that balance to pull that back of how do you know when it's like, well, this is, I'm still proud of this. I'm still feel comfortable shipping with this, but I know all that's, you know, cause like obviously you know all the problems, you know, all the things that could have been better, but you have to get that, be able to sort of at some point you draw a line and say, yep, this is good enough. And mm-hmm. that's what a point release is for.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. You know, I was lucky in that, when I was a kid, my dad taught me a lot of things, a lot of phrases like cost-benefit analysis, the law of diminishing returns, and so on and so on. His temperament was to tend to be a perfectionist in all things all the time, but he had learned enough about economics to know when to analyze stuff, to pull back from that insane level of perfectionism. And so I got taught that rather young. So I, you know, learned how to strike that balance. It's still hard, though. You still just want to, like, no, let's wait until it's perfect.
Yeah. Though I think the interesting part is, after having done this for a while, I think in the end, as much as I may think it's not the case or conceptually think it's not the case, my gut says, too, that the software we end up with as a result of that constraint is better than it would have been otherwise. It's that the trying to guess what your customers will need can often be such a dangerous like rabbit hole to go down.
Oh, it sure can. Yeah. And when I'm working with people who are less experienced, than I am, which is most of the time, just because I've been around long enough.
Sure.
That's something I remind them of all the time. It's like, we don't know what they're going to want. We're going to ship 1.0 and then find out what they actually want. And I guarantee you, there'll be some surprises, some things that we thought they would want may not be that big a deal. And then there'll be some things possibly we haven't even thought of. So it's better to, especially with 1.0, to go as minimal as you possibly can and then learn about the software from your users.
Yeah. So when you're building something and you find yourself just running up against a wall and you're kind of stuck, whether that's technically or design or business oriented or whatever it is, what's the process that you sort of dive into to overcome that? Like, do you have, so you're just, you know, you're working on something, you just can't get it to work. What do you do at that point?
That's a really good question. I think I just keep going.
You just keep.
Yeah, I don't know. I just keep going. And I either get to the point where I get it working or discover that it's actually technically not doable, or find out that it's massively expensive and then just behave accordingly. Usually, though, I know in advance if something is just completely undoable, so I don't even try. But if it is doable, then I ought to be able to do it. And so I just keep going until I can.
Yeah, because I find it's interesting, because I know some people I've worked with, when they hit something, they almost have like a workflow they go into. It's like they put on a certain kind of music, or they go to a special place or whatever, and to try and, like, you know, it's like you're debugging that really hard problem or whatever. And I think it's just interesting how, I think I'm more like you, where I'll just keep at it. And it's like, I'll all of a sudden look up and it's 5 hours later and I'm like, what just happened? What did I just do? You open up your source control and you're like, nothing's changed. It's like you just kept trying and then undoing, trying and undoing, trying and undoing.
So. Yeah, that's pretty much how I approach it. And sometimes time gets away from me, and it might end up being quite a bit after midnight before I finally give up. That's true. I don't have any special method for that. It just seems like programming to me, only it's harder that day.
Yeah. So. When you're doing your development, are there particular tools or things that you your favorite tools for that maybe are outside of Xcode, things that you find you use all the time when you're developing?
Let's see. I use Xscope an awful lot to make sure, you know, I've got exactly 11 pixels or something when I think I should. And that's a great tool. It's from the Icon Factory. Fantastic tool. When I'm doing design work, I use Scala Preview, I think it's called, from Django. And that's awesome because it pipes the frontmost window in Photoshop directly to your iPhone. So you make a change in Photoshop, you can see what's happening on your iPhone right away, you know, without having to, you know, put some rectangle over things or whatever.
Sure.
Like you do with some of those. And that's really, really awesome. I'd like to say that I've started using Kaleidoscope, but I haven't actually started using Kaleidoscope yet because I have to update some script to switch from file merge to Kaleidoscope. Mm. I've looked at Kaleidoscope and I think it's awesome. Of course, I use BBEdit as a text editor a ton. What else? I'm a Mercurial guy rather than a Git guy, but I just use it on the command line. I use Glassboard for communicating with my team.
That's good.
We use Lighthouse for bugs. We use Bitbucket for repositories. I think that's just about it outside of the normal tools.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty that's pretty much the whole tool chain. How do you find yourself in something like Photoshop? Do you feel comfortable in there, or is that kind of treading into a place that that developers rarely tread?
Well, for a long time, I'd say I designed my own apps. I certainly designed NetNewsWire, though I didn't do the icons. But they were never really they were never really that custom. You know, it was stock widgets with some, you know, maybe small custom changes, but it was pretty basic. Nowadays, with iOS, of course, you've really got to design the hell out of stuff. And I realized that, you know, I'm no more a born programmer than I am a born anything else. You know, so I could learn how to do Photoshop and do at least competent graphic design if I took the time and sat down and did it. And so for the last couple of years, I have spent a lot of time in Photoshop working on those skills. And I wouldn't say that I'm a really good graphic designer yet, but for certain types of things, I do okay, and I'm getting better every time I work on it. So it's been really fun.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it's especially when you're working in a much smaller team, you know, in terms of being independent or working with in a very small company, being able to open up, feel pretty comfortable in both Xcode and Photoshop seems like it's an absolute essential. Like, I've talked to some other developers who just, they're like, oh no, I have. It's like, you know, it's like, or they don't even have something like Photoshop. It's like I don't even know what they're using to kind of do that kind of work. But it seems that at this point, it's like you just kind of have to. It's just, it's not a, so much of your app is not about the code these days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
That's like, you just kind of got to feel comfortable. I mean, it's like, maybe you're not, yeah, it's like you're not someone who's in there as an artist, you know, drawing amazing things, but there's a certain amount of just making things aesthetically interesting and clean or useful in that way that you just kind of have to feel comfortable with. And
yeah, in fact, you know, I think I use Photoshop 100 times more than I use Interface Builder.
Yeah.
I almost don't use it at all. It kind of is Interface Builder, and then I have to translate it all into code. But still, you know, Interface Builder, you hardly ever get something that looks like what you're actually going to run. And Photoshop, you can make it look exactly like what it's going to look like on screen, or at least pretty close, given the Photoshop's crappy text rendering.
Yeah.
Other than that, you can get it to look just like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you make an interesting point there, because I do think as I've gotten better at development, and I think especially on a platform like iOS, its Interface Builder has almost nothing to do with the appearance of my interface. And I use it less and less. And when I'm using it, I'm only using it even just for sort of structural layout and stuff. It's got nothing to do with what the components look like. It's got nothing to do with the actual aesthetic. Usually, it's just it's an easy way to lay out components, and then you can apply your layout, you know, auto resizing rules and stuff, and play with it to make it work. It's just like a convenient tool for that, I find.
Yeah,
But less and less, it's actually, I guess it's not building my interface anymore.
Mm-hmm. So many of my apps are basically table view apps with a detail view, and Interface Builder isn't necessarily a big help for that, right? It's really easy in code to add a table and hook all that stuff up. You know, it's just a few lines of code, and you know, it's a lot easier to look at changes and diffs and everything too if you have that stuff in code. If I had more complicated views with, you know, very unique view hierarchies and so on, in those cases, I use nibs. And if you look at my last app, Glassboard, it has, I don't know, probably 20 different nibs. So I do use them, but not unless I absolutely have to.
Yeah, where do you come down in terms, you're using them when it's easier to lay it out visually than it is in code, or is it do you just sort of tend to go in code until you run out of runway and you're like, well, I guess I just will pull this up into a nib?
I guess I have an instinct for it now. You know, say you've got a user profile screen. So in that case, you've got a picture of the user, some information, maybe, you know, two or three buttons, table view, you know, just a bunch of kind of disparate stuff. And I may have mocked it up in Photoshop, but I realized, well, it's going to take a lot of just like monkey code, right, to instantiate each one of those and then set all the properties and set the frames and everything. In a case like that, it's a lot faster to go ahead and use Interface Builder. So in those cases, I will. But there are other times, like the table view cells in my last app, Glassboard, were very complicated. I hope they don't look complicated, but they in fact are extraordinarily complicated and very dynamic. And there was no way that laying those out in Interface Builder was going to get me any kind of benefit whatsoever. So in that case, those were done entirely in code.
Yeah.
But for static stuff, Interface Builder is really fantastic.
Do you ever, when you look at something like storyboards and all of that sort of whole, it seems like there's this whole sort of parallel way of building apps that Apple is presenting. Do you have any interest in that side of things?
I'm a little afraid of storyboards. I worry that it's one of those paths where you go down and then suddenly you want to do something that used to be easy to do and now it's really difficult. I also worry about them being, you know, one big file.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really play all that great with source control. Yeah, I don't know. I've just kind of steered clear of them.
Yeah, I've played around with them as one of those things that usually when Apple puts a lot of effort behind something and says you should, you know, this makes it a big part of, you know, the developer tools. It's like, it's something I should probably look at. But every time I look at it, it's just like, it doesn't seem like it makes anything any easier. I mean, yeah, maybe that's just coming from being experienced. Like if you were a new developer or someone coming at this fresh, it'd be easier to do. But for me, it's like, that's not easier. That's making it harder to do a lot of the, a lot of the stuff that I could do already.
Yeah. I also worry about the, I don't know what to term this effect, but you've probably heard it said or read somewhere where people say that the tonal varieties in music have really narrowed over the past 10 or so years as certain digital tools have become absolutely prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So that the way music sounds, it sounds more alike. Each song sounds more alike than it used to. And I worry about that with the tools too. If, you know, everybody uses storyboards, we're just going to have apps that can be storyboarded.
Sure.
And so I don't feel too bad about not using those kinds of things. Just if for no other reason than to make sure there's some, you know, variety of application out there in the ecosystem.
Yeah, and it is interesting too when you say that, because I would say iOS and especially the iOS App Store is an environment where being distinctive is essential to a large degree. That it's very hard to make a splash or to have any kind of commercial success if you're not doing something that feels novel in some way.
Mm, sure, yeah.
And so it's an interesting thing when you say that. It's like, yeah, it's a difficulty if you go down that road of getting too, you know, if you're too cookie cutter in that way, it may serve a purpose. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's like you're just a consultant building an app for, I don't know, some reservation system or something that doesn't need to be, I don't know, unique in that way. But if you're trying to stand out, it'll be much more difficult to do using that kind of a tool.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, standing out is hard. There's over 500,000 apps now. Jeez, it's crazy.
I think there's. I thought there was 1 million apps in the store.
1 million now? Yeah, I don't even know.
It's something
I can't
like
count them anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the reality. I think it's at this point, I've stopped paying attention to some ways because there's so many that it stops mattering. It's beyond whatever that point was where you could just sort of easily stand out in a way that it's like when you're the difference between 1 out of 1 million and being 1 out of 1 million and 10,000 or whatever, it's almost no difference.
Yeah.
It's just, which is kind of a crazy thing. I mean, it's like, I don't know, where do you say in terms of like, I don't know, is there, in terms of the you hear a lot of people talk about it especially as a smaller developer, that there's fewer and fewer opportunities to sort of make a stable living in the App Store, that it gets harder and harder to stand out. It's harder and harder to compete against people with larger budgets, larger teams. Obviously you still see some opportunity because otherwise you wouldn't be coming back into this kind of a marketplace. But where do you kind of see the outlook there?
That's a good question. I think that a very well done app that's very well marketed by a very small team can do exceptionally well. And it doesn't necessarily have to make as much money, right? Because
yes.
if you have a small team, you have, you know, fewer people sharing in the profits. But then again, it could make as much money. Larger teams have a lot of, you know, going back to corporate constraints and stuff. Larger teams have problems. You know, the people who are putting up that money up front, you know, have certain expectations. You know, you're going to ship this thing in October, or, you know, I'm going to fire half of you or whatever, you know, and that stuff can really hurt a project. Whereas a smaller team, if they can hold on, can do something better because they can give themselves the time to do something better. So I don't know. You know, it seems like so many of the biggest hits have been done by small teams. Like that to-do list Clear, that's a relatively small team, right? Mm-hmm. But it's done fantastically well. Marco Arma, I think, does very, very well. Lauren Brichter has done super well. There are a lot of small teams that have done amazingly. Or the Tweetbot guys. What's the name of them? AppBots?
TapBots.
I forget the name of TapBots, yeah.
Right. Yeah, Paul and yeah. Mark.
Yeah, right. I mean, they've done fantastically well, right? Icon Factory. There's a lot of small teams that do super well.
Yeah. And I think whenever I hear people talking in those ways, it seems like a lot of it, there's this weird disconnect between, like, you always, almost always, it's accompanied with a picture showing the top grossing apps in the store, mm-hmm. which is perhaps the most irrelevant example of the store. In terms of, from an actual practical level, it doesn't make any difference what the person making the most is making for mm-hmm. you as a business to know. Like, I don't need to be making be the number one grossing app in the store to be able to have a sustainable business.
And yeah, like, that's right. Yeah.
And I think that's the interesting part. Cause I mean, obviously that's like, this is what I've been doing supporting myself in the app store for like four and a bit years now. And it's like, it's the same as it ever was. It seems to me, it's like, it's just, you just kind of keep, You make enough interesting things, people like them, and you don't need that many people to like you to support you if your costs are, you know, your overheads are much lower, your ability to kind of just, and your ability to switch rapidly in terms of if something isn't working, you can just be like, all right, that didn't work. What's the next thing?
Yeah. Being nimble definitely has its advantages. Absolutely. And I think the bar keeps getting raised, but then again, we all get better as developers too, and the costs of things like back-end services keep going down. So as the bar is getting raised, we're better able to meet it.
Yeah. And I think there's even too, I've definitely seen a change in people's, in some ways I'm glad that people think, if the broad consensus is that whatever, like the terrible term, but it's like everyone always uses, like the gold rush is over, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I think that's a good thing in terms of the type of person who wants to sort of go at it in the app stores mm-hmm. is probably different than if you're sort of coming in to try and make a quick buck, then the kind of software you're going to create is a very different thing.
I never understood the mentality of people thinking, oh, you know, I'll work really hard and write some great software for a quick buck.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not doing it because you love it, because the money allows you to keep doing what you love, then you've got it backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and I think a lot of that I mean, I don't even know if it's just that difference in some people are, you should almost call it like craftsmen in a way rather than, I don't even know if it is like the opposite is like businessmen or whatever, mm-hmm. where it's like, are you doing the work? Are you working so that you can make money, or are you making money so that you can work? Like at the end of the day, I try as best as I can to keep in the mindset of like, I just want to make enough money that I can keep doing what I like.
Yeah.
That's all I need. It doesn't have to, the goal is not how much, you know, if I wanted to make the most money possible, I'd probably be doing consulting just cause.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I'd hate that. I've done that. It's not nearly as interesting as just being able to solve harder problems that, you know, at a lower level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Consulting. Sucks. I've done just a little amount of it, and it was many years ago, but boy, yeah, I couldn't stand it.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some people who for whom it works, but
yeah, sure. Yeah, there are. Yeah. So I think of us as kind of like the modern equivalent of the village toy maker.
Yeah.
You know, every village had that guy who would, you know, make toys and maybe furniture too, but he loved making toys, right?
Yeah.
And his audience was just, you know, the people nearby. It wasn't a billion people. It was, you know, whoever lived in or passed through the village, but it was plenty and he did well.
Yeah. And he did enough. All he had to do was enough to keep doing what he was doing, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's the best definition. It's like, the nice thing too, you imagine that person, his definition of success was unlikely tied to his revenues. It was tied to the smiles on the kids' faces, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, and the day he comes up with a new way to make the giraffe's legs bend or something, he's like, this is great. The kids are going to love this, you know. Like, those are his good days, right? And it's the same for us.
Yeah, it's like that day when you work out that you have that breakthrough in whatever it was, that thing mm-hmm. that you didn't think you could do, you find a way to do it, or that mm-hmm. interaction that I always love, especially with something like iOS where it's tactile, there's that magic point where all of a sudden it just kind of works. And like mm-hmm. you get the whatever your scrolling performance right, and all of a sudden it's just it goes from being from being chunky to being smooth, and you're like, wow, that's awesome.
yeah those are good days. I love that stuff. Another part I like is, you know, when you've got the mock-ups and you've gone through and done, you know, the database and you know, all the like low level stuff, and now you're working on the UI and you start from, you know, just the plainest whatever table view or whatever unstyled stuff, and then every little change you make that makes it look a little bit more like the mock-ups, what, you know, the actual vision of the app. Every little change just feels great. It's like the app is coming alive right before your very eyes. And that's a really, really fun feeling. A friend of mine called that the Pinocchio effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like watching the puppet turn into a real boy. It's really cool.
Yeah, and it's funny how that, especially I find when you spend a lot of time getting to that point, it makes it even more rewarding. Or it suddenly comes to life, and rather than just being a picture, it's a thing.
Yeah, right.
That you can hand to somebody and be like, "Hey, try this."
Mm-hmm. The psychology of that is so interesting, because I know that, you know, getting using the right color or whatever is like, you know, it's just small lines of simple code, right? Setting a text color or a font or, you know, the many things. And so, you know, I work on the back end and everything, get the low level stuff done first, knowing that the styling won't be that hard, and, you know, but still when it happens, even though it's the simplest code often, it still feels so dramatic. It feels so good.
Yeah.
And I think it's just cause now you really see it.
Yeah. And so as you're kind of, obviously you're coming back into independent world in some ways with a blank slate, like you're unencumbered by a lot of history in terms of, you know, it's like past projects or things that you have to be maintaining. So where do you see the biggest opportunities in, I guess, Apple software, if I wanted to narrow it down these days, like where do you think the most neglected parts of kind of the software stores? And
surely it must be to-do lists and Twitter clients, right?
Of course.
That's a good question. I don't necessarily look for, you know, the biggest opportunities, because there's certain kinds of software that I make and certain kinds of software I don't make. So I'm probably just going to make the kind of software that I like to make. Odds are I'll never ever write a game. I don't play games very often outside of letterpress. And so I don't really think in terms of games much. What I do tend to think of is in terms of reading and writing, and to a certain extent publishing. Just about everything I've ever done has had to do with reading and writing. So, you know, in that kind of, and whether that's productivity or social networking or whatever, however you might describe an RSS reader, those are the fields where I'll tend to gravitate. And I don't know what the big opportunities there are. I think there's just always big opportunities for a fresh approach to a problem executed really, really well.
Yeah. It's not about being the first. It's about being the best or being...
Yeah. It's too late to be the first. NetNewsWire years ago was the first Cocoa RSS reader, at least the first one that actually made it to 1.0. And I think that was a big advantage in 2003 when that shipped. But in those days, you know, there were obviously no iPhones or anything, and there was no App Store, and there wasn't that much Mac software. So you could reach pretty much the entire Mac community that way, or at least the Mac community that paid attention. And so it was cool to be first. But these days, I don't think it matters one tiny bit. What matters is being awesome.
Yeah. Do you feel more excited about working on iOS or on the Mac these days?
I think probably more about the Mac, only because it's been a while since I've done Mac software. And Mac software was really my first love. So I'm really, really itching to go work on a Mac app. And I think I will be, but I'm not just yet. I'm working on an iPhone app at the moment. But probably in the next couple months, I'll do file new on a Mac project.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll feel great. Oh, I'm so psyched. I even love all the like stupid stuff, like making the app scriptable and, you know, kind of the things that people don't really see all that much. But just taking care of all the many, many details of a Mac app, that's something I spent a lot of years doing and something I definitely grew to love.
Yeah, because it's funny. Whenever I've done some work on the Mac, but every time I try and do it, I feel like it's a platform that has such a high bar of institutional knowledge for creating something really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Especially coming from like an iOS background, which had such a sort of a clean slate. Like it's all these things that on the Mac that you have to, yeah, like you talk about with like making something scriptable or all those types of things that are. Mac software is so multidimensional in what you can do with it and how it works that it's intimidating for someone coming at it from, it's like, I learned Objective-C, learned Cocoa, all that on the iOS. And then I was like, how hard can it be? And it's like, it's very hard.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. It's big. It really is. Just having menus all of a sudden. Yeah, it makes a big difference. And some concepts that are huge in Cocoa on the Mac are hardly ever touched on iOS. For instance, the responder chain is a big deal in a Mac app. On iOS, yeah, it may not even come up for you pretty much at all.
Yeah. Do you see, obviously there's been a bit of a process of whatever, like taking iOS concepts and bringing them back and putting them on the Mac. Do you see that... Where do you see that ending as someone who has a lot of history on the Mac but experience on iOS? Like, do you think where we are with AppKit and kind of the way that you build and structure apps on the Mac is sort of the way forward? Or is it, do you think at some point there'll be a discontinuity there and it would kind of change how we do things on the Mac?
I don't expect a discontinuity. I expect, you know, constant iteration. Taking good ideas and bringing them to the Mac and vice versa too, actually. But Apple does do discontinuities, but super rarely, right? The switch to Cocoa was a huge one. And of course that was, you know, with the whole switch in operating system and so on. I can't picture them doing anything even a tenth as jarring as that for many, many, many years to come. So I think, yeah, we'll see AppKit continue to evolve, and we'll see the Mac system continue to evolve. And a lot of it's in small ways, like we finally have view-based table cells in AppKit, which we didn't have for years. And we had that in iOS, and it was such an obvious good thing. I was glad that was brought over to AppKit. But, you know, there's a lot of things in UIKit that I just kind of bristle at when I see in a Mac app. For instance, when you have that navigation controller style navigation in a Mac app, that always just kind of freaks me out a little bit. It doesn't seem to fit right.
Yeah.
So not every iOS idea belongs over on the Mac.
Yeah, and it's, I think though it's interesting because, which is just what you said, like with the navigation based thing. I think, I feel like there is, I've seen much more and more, like more and more of that type of thing, where it's taking an idiom that was designed for a touchscreen and just moved on to a Mac, or you know, it's like creating, they, you know, they're kind of it's almost like you're just taking probably closer to like an iPad app and just running it on your Mac because that's what you're used to.
Mm-hmm, right.
Kind of ignoring the fact that there's a reason why that kind of an interface worked well on an iPhone and why it
and doesn't work well on a Mac. Yeah.
Or really, or just the fact that it's not really necessary in the same way that it's, you know, like a nav, like the nav controller comes from a world where you can only display one very limited screen of information at a time. Right.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so it makes sense that you kind of build these stacks up that way. But on a Mac, you've got, I mean, I'm sitting in front of a 27-inch display sitting next to a 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro. I've got plenty of pixels. It's not a question of, you know, I can only just having this tiny little window into my into my apps data or what's going on. It's like I can display all of it and give my give myself a much more powerful interface into that as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you need three panes to show the entire hierarchy, just do it. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so, at sort of a taking a step, sort of at a higher level, what do you think are some of the, as in sort of having been someone who's been doing this for quite a long time, what are kind of some of the biggest mistakes you've made, whether technically or at a business level, and the sort of things you want to make sure you never do again, or things, lessons you've learned the hardest way?
That's a good question. I think the biggest mistakes I ever made were when I was still working on NetNewsWire, and it was just a Mac app at the time, and I knew that I wanted to redo the storage layer because it had been written before Core Data, and I wanted to use Core Data or SQLite, and I had been using SQLite only minimally at that time. So it needed a rewrite. But then what happened was that the iPhone came along and the App Store came along. And I wanted to get the iPhone version on the store on day one. And so then I did. And, you know, that was a deadline and I had to make it. And since I didn't like the storage system written on the Mac, I wrote a whole new one for iPhone. And ship that, but now I have two apps that don't actually share any code, pretty much, which, you know, is a maintenance problem. But that was okay, so I'm like, okay, well, I'll you know, fix it later. But then as I was, you know, fixing it, trying to get the two code bases to share code, share a common storage system and everything, then the iPad came out, and I'm like, well, okay, I'll rewrite all this stuff yet again for the iPad version and make sure that it's on the store on day one. And so I did. And what I ended up having then was three versions of NetNewsWire, all of which didn't actually share any code. And there was pretty much just me working on it, though I had a little help on the iPad version. It was still, you know, me with three similar apps that don't share any code. And at that point, I was just really in technical debt hell.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get them to share code. I was still actually trying to, you know, work on the storage system and syncing system and all that to make it really, really good. And, you know, at the same time, there were bugs to fix, new features to release. You know, the whole thing was expected that I'd keep it going and make money. And yet I felt like I needed to start over from scratch, you know, and just redo the whole thing. And there were a lot of days where I would just change my mind, you know, about what direction to take, you know, on multiple times a day, and just get frustrated because it was a big mountain to climb. And in the end, what I eventually did was ship NetNewsWire Lite 4.0 on the Mac App Store, and that used what would have been the shared code base for all of the apps. Except then we sold NetNewsWire to Blackpixel. So now it's up to them, which was not a mistake. That was a good thing to do. But my mistake was, you know, insisting on being in the App Store and not paying enough attention to the growing technical debt until it really just exploded on me.
Do you think at the time when you were going through that, that you had an awareness, or is that kind of like a boiling frog problem?
I think I was insufficiently aware. And, you know, every day is just another day. Well, or every release is just another release, right? It's like, well, let me do this and then I'll get to it, you know? Or it's more important to be on the App Store on day one, you know, for iPhone and then for iPad, you know, I thought, than it would have been to hang back, show some discipline, get all this stuff sorted out before doing that. Because, you know, day one of a new App Store is not something that's going to come along very often in your career, right? And, you know, I hit it with iPhone and iPad. But the Mac App Store, I did not, because I already knew I was in so much trouble. There was no way I was going to make day one of the Mac App Store.
Even though you already had a Mac app.
Yeah, that... but it needed to be, you know, it needed redoing. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think those are often such the hardest things to have awareness of, though, right? Because in some ways that's a benefit of being in a larger organization where there's somebody whose job it is to watch out for that, rather than having to wear all those hats yourself. Where it's like, I'm in the, like, when I put on my business hat, I'm like, well, I need to be on the App Store on day one because that's a nice financial boon and kind of get a foothold there and so on. But at the same time, what is that costing? What's the trade-off I'm making to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It was, and you know, if I had to do it over again, I might make the same mistake the same way, because whatever the equivalent of an App Store day one is, it's a really, really big deal. I hope I wouldn't make the same mistake though. Jeez, I'm a lot more sensitive to tech debt than I used to be. I would much rather take the extra time, and being independent again means I can, which is important. I'm also a lot better programmer than I was in those days, which, you know, I don't fall into the trap as easily. In other words, I just write better code.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's like,
which could be arrogance, and I might not be seeing something I should be seeing. So it's always something to look at.
Well, it begs the question for me, if it's like, how would somebody get to the to that level, right? It's like, how could you transfer that skill of just writing better code to someone else? It's like, what advice would you give them if that's what they're trying to get to? Is it just just do it for years, or?
Yeah, keep at it, keep doing it. And I think there are maybe a few things. One is, If you think that you're a really good programmer and now you're awesome and now you can do, you know, whatever, you might want to remember to be humble, because it's probably not true that you're actually awesome yet. You know, remember the code you wrote 6 months ago, you look at some of that and you go, what the hell was I thinking? Well, 6 months from now, it's going to be the same way, or maybe a year from now, whatever. So, you know, try to stay humble. Also stay curious. Don't ever think, well, I've learned it, I'm good, I'll just, you know, keep putting out stuff based on what I know. You can continue to get better and just stay hungry, looking for ways to get better. Look for different points of view, look at other languages even, or even APIs you don't ever expect to use. I've been learning OpenGL recently, and I may never, ever have any reason to use OpenGL in something. But in fact, I may have no direct practical benefit from learning it. But learning it helps my programming mind develop. It makes it better. Learning anything new does that. So just keep learning and stay humble. And then you'll be awesome like me.
Then you'll be awesome like you. Just
end. Yeah, right. That's a lack of humility, I think.
Yeah, it's like, but it's like repeat for decades, and you'll be there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And you know, there are a lot of programmers better than I am out there, and so my goal is, you know, just keep getting better. As long as I keep looking back at code I wrote and you know, sometimes going, what the hell was that? If I can keep doing that, then I know I'm still improving. If I look back, you know, a year from now at code I'm writing today and don't wonder about some of it, then that means I've stagnated. It doesn't mean that I've gotten to such an awesome point that I can't get better. It just means I've stagnated, and that'd be bad.
Yeah, and I think what I found along with that is it's the importance of putting yourself, exposing yourself to people who you think are better than you, mm-hmm. In whatever sense would make sense for your situation. But it's like, as an independent, I think especially I found that it's like, if it's easy for me to just end up in my own little island doing my own little thing, that it's a crazy thing where you sit down with somebody else and they look at what you're doing. They're like, what are you thinking? Like, that's
right. Yeah.
And you just, it's so easy to get stuck into that in a way that it's like, in some ways being independent is great, 'cause I can work with anybody. You know, the world is, you know, it's like, I'm not constrained by an org chart. It's, if I want to work with somebody, I can call them up and say, hey, you want to do a project together? Or can I hire you as a consultant to look at something I've been working on? Or, you know, it's like hiring a graphics guy to help you see your problem in a different way or in a new way or those kinds of things. That's, I think, it's worth the thing that I found. It's like the best thing to kind of keep you accountable for that.
Mm-hmm. So the thing we do here in Seattle is we don't have Cocoa Heads, but we have something called the Seattle X-Coders. And we get together twice a month and, you know, talk over code and architecture and all kinds of different things. And we talk about other subjects too, of course,
because
there's a social aspect. But that really helps a lot. It helps to talk, even just talking verbally to other developers on a regular basis about different stuff. Yeah, I've gotten a ton of value out of that.
Yeah, and similarly, I always think of like with going to a conference or something like that. It's often less about the presentations even necessarily. It's just being able to be bouncing ideas off people who you don't often get to sit in the same room with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, conferences are fantastic. And it's important to talk to people at conferences. I feel a little bad because there's always, you know, some certain percentage of people who I think go and listen to the sessions and then go back to their hotel room or whatever. And they're missing the bigger part of the experience.
Yeah, though it is so hard. I mean, I was that person for years, and it is, and I've talked about it, I think, many times, and even on Developing Perspective. It's like, at some point you just have to get over it and realize this is part of your job. And it's kind of like if you're going to a mandatory all hands meeting, if you're like working for the man, right? And you get the email and it's like, all right, everybody's got to be down in the conference room at 4:30 for an all hands meeting. It's like, I don't want to go. I know I don't enjoy this. I'm not going to have fun. This is not good. You just kind of be like, well, that's what I got to do. And so I'm just going to go sit and try and find people to talk to and strike up conversation. And every time I've done it, it's always been easier than I thought it would have been.
Oh, sure. I think two things to remember. In general, people are friendly. And if you talk to them, they're happy because they didn't have to try and talk to you first.
Yeah.
You know, people like to like other people. You know, if you come up to someone, they're going to want to like you. They're going to start by thinking they're probably going to like you, right?
Yeah.
Other people are just as shy as you are, you know. And that wasn't easy for me. And it's true of a lot of software developers, I think, that, you know, that social stuff can be difficult. But, you know, just remember everyone else is more or less like you in that score. Yeah. And then it's not so hard.
Yeah. And you just, especially, it's like you just gets better over time. It's a skill just like anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
So I think that's where I'm going to be wrapping it up for today. Before we go, though, I just wanted to ask you, if people wanted to, you know, follow you online, see what you're doing, see whatever the new secret projects that are going to be coming out of Ranchero in the future.
Many secret projects.
Well,
one or two anyway, yeah. My weblog's probably the best place. That's inessential.com. Or on Twitter, I am Brent Simmons.
Great. And yeah, so I just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time. I think I've definitely learned a few things, which is always great. And I hope everyone else did too.
Cool. Thanks, Dave.